The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. We have a lot to get to on today's program. Here at Edstone in the UK, we just completed our campout, where I didn't get an exact count, actually, but that ended yesterday, or this morning, actually. Our last remaining campers left the property, left the grounds, and so it feels a little bit empty around here, but still lots and lots of activity going on inside of Edstone Hall, including this particular radio program. It's been a fast-moving summer. The kids, my kids anyway, are back in school today for their first day of school. And so there's excitement in the family for them, and they're anxious and eager to get started. It's a little bit of an early start, I guess, compared to some other schools in the UK. But still, August 10th, it really does highlight how fast this summer has gone. Today we're going to talk about a number of things. Firstly, an experiment that's going on inside of a British school. The BBC is talking about this with a three-part series, and it's an experiment with putting Chinese instructors inside of a British schoolroom to see the difference between Chinese education as compared to Britain. We'll look more at that later on in the program. I also just want to update you some on President Obama's latest remarks, or his defense of the Iran nuclear deal. Some polls are now showing that by a 2-to-1 margin, Americans are against this deal. And it seems to run parallel with the sentiment at Congress as well, where a majority, at least, of congressmen and women are against this deal. The president over the weekend had an interview, I think it was recorded last week, just after his long speech at American University. But it was with CNN, and it was played, I believe, yesterday. So we'll give you a few excerpts from his remarks. Also, I want to update you on a big weekend as far as the Key of David program is concerned here in the UK. We got a big response for a program that happened to be a repeat. That played just 3 months ago. So in the second segment, we'll update you on some of those stats. We'll update you on our goal for reaching 2,000 Mystery of the Ages distribution, that goal that we set a few months ago. And we'll also give you some additional stats just on some of the listeners, or rather some of the facts on the listeners with the program, and then also some reader feedback as well. And then finally, in the third segment, and this does depend on how much time is left, but I'd like to get back into the Sermon on the Mount. If you've been following the program regularly, you know that we've made it up through Matthew 6, and so I'd like to make a little bit of headway on Matthew 7, if possible, today. But I want to begin with this. You heard it at the top of the hour, the anniversary in Ferguson and the shots that rang out in that fairly tense situation. Here in the UK, the report was from the Telegraph, shots fired at Ferguson marks 1 year since the police killing of Michael Brown. It says two people were struck by gunfire in the midst of a late-night confrontation on Sunday between riot police and protesters, police said, after a day of peaceful events in Ferguson, Missouri, commemorating the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer 1 year ago. Gunshots erupted as police were seeking to disperse a crowd of demonstrators who began blocking traffic and smashing windows along a street that was a flashpoint of last year's unrest following the slaying of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Now, you compare this. We've had a lot to say here recently about what happened in Charleston a couple of months ago. But you compare this. I mean, here we are 1 year on from Ferguson, and still it doesn't take much for things to erupt into black-on-white, white-on-black violence. In Charleston, nothing like this happened. Not even the first day after the massacre. My father said about Charleston that it was one of the most amazing stories in U.S. history, at least as far as race relations is concerned. The fact that that community didn't erupt in violence. What a difference. Now we have these protests again in Ferguson, and you have all the usual suspects rushing forward to talk about just how many black people are being killed at the hands of white police officers. The protesters, the article says, locking arms and edging closer to the police cordon, began throwing water bottles and shouting, "We are ready for war." In their minds, it's gotten so bad that they're ready. They're prepared for race war. And many in the media are egging them on. This Telegraph piece, it says white doves were released after 4.5 minutes of silence to represent the roughly 4.5 hours that Brown's body lay in the middle of the street after he was shot. A crowd of about 1,000 then embarked on a silent march through Ferguson to honor Brown and others killed in confrontations with police. Here these white doves are released shortly before violence erupts. The Telegraph says another name was added to the list on Friday with unarmed 19-year-old Christian Taylor, a black college student, who was shot dead by a white police officer investigating a burglary at a car dealership in Arlington, Texas. So this young black man was killed over the weekend, and again an outpouring on Twitter and other social media sites saying that it was unjust. Saying that it was the same old, another white policeman, trigger happy. But this victim, Taylor, he drove his SUV. These details, by the way, were left out of the Telegraph piece. He drove his SUV through the car dealership's metal gate. He busted the gate. Then he vandalized one of the cars on the car lot. And then he drove his SUV through the showroom glass. The police arrived, as you would expect. A struggle ensued. Resistance to arrest. And then one of the officers fatally shot Taylor. As I say, the Telegraph left out quite a few of those details. It was, though, covered elsewhere here in the UK. The Daily Mail did cover quite a lot of that. But that's not the case with so many voices in the media that leave out context, or that just dismiss this behavior, lawless behavior, as if the policeman should just step aside and give that individual space to destroy. So many are going to be coming forward again, no doubt, calling on something to change, something to be done because of this epidemic of violence. This epidemic of policemen coming on too strong. When, as you hear these arguments, if you get perspective, 93% of black killings in America are committed by other black people. And that's the real epidemic of violence that never does get the same billing as some of these smaller incidents. There was another story, by the way, just staying here on the subject of minorities there in America, the Washington Times, an article from Friday. It says DHS admits new surge of illegal immigrant families. This is from August 7th, the Washington Times. It says the country saw another surge of illegal immigrant families crossing the border in July, a top Homeland Security official told a federal court late Thursday, as the administration begged a judge not to forbid detention of new migrant mothers and children. It quotes this deputy patrol officer or border patrol officer who said the number of illegal immigrant families captured at the border rose in July, bucking a trend and worrying officials who had been expecting the number of families to drop as the heat increases in late summer, just as the number of unaccompanied minors does. So they were hopeful. They were expecting it to drop just because of the summer heat, and it didn't. It rose. More and more are streaming in, to the United States from Mexico and from other nations in Central America. It's a problem that, as we've been saying all along, is just worsening. No sign of it getting any better. Well, as far as that interview, I mentioned Mr. Obama's comments over the weekend. Again, he's out there actively trying to defend this Iran deal because so many people are against it. So many people in the United States, in Israel, around the Middle East, in Congress. He sat down with a reporter yesterday, or it was played yesterday, on CNN. And we'll go ahead and play this first clip for you.
Since you announced the agreement with Iran, it appears, if you look at several recent polls, that a majority of the American public oppose it and a majority of the United States Congress oppose it. Why do you think that is?
Because people haven't been getting all the information. It's a complicated piece of business. And we are negotiating with a regime that chants death to America and doesn't have a high approval rating here in the United States. But the people who know most about the central challenge that we're trying to deal with, which is making sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon, they are overwhelmingly in favor of it.
So Americans are against it by a 2-to-1 margin, according to many polls. A majority in Congress oppose the deal. But as he brings out there, supposedly the people who really understand what's happening are in favor of the deal. I'm sure that doesn't make too many people feel much better about the details of it. The interviewer then goes on and asks the president just about this comparison. This is the comment he made last week in that speech that got most of the headlines, where he compared the Republicans in Congress to the hardliners in Iran. Listen.
In your speech at American University, you made a comparison. You said that Iran's hardliners were making common cause with Republicans. It's come under a lot of criticism. Mitch McConnell says even Democrats who oppose the deal should be insulted. The Wall Street Journal says that this rhetoric shows that you've abandoned the hope of getting any Republicans or even moderate Democrats, and you are targeting this message to the hardcore of House Democrats who are going to sustain your veto.
Fareed, your question is about politics. Let me talk about substance. What I said is absolutely true factually. The truth of the matter is, inside of Iran, the people most opposed to the deal are the Revolutionary Guard, the Quds Force, hardliners who are implacably opposed to any cooperation with the international community. And there's a reason for that, because they recognize that if, in fact, this deal gets done, that rather than them being in the driver's seat with respect to the Iranian economy, they are in a weaker position.
So the hard, again, you heard some of this last week, the hardliners are weakened by the deal. But I just want to contrast this comment that he made there, because this is another one that I have for you here in a second. It's from the same interview. And notice what the president said in this same interview about Iran's supreme leader.
You talked about Iran's hardliners, the old guard. Well, one member of Iran's old guard certainly seems to be Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader.
I think he would qualify.
He would qualify, right? And he seems relentlessly anti-American.
Yes.
His Twitter feed has posted a likeness of you with a gun pointed to your head.
Yes.
Is this a guy you can really make a deal with?
Well, as I said, don't negotiate deals with your friends. You negotiate them with your enemies. And superpowers don't respond to taunts. Superpowers focus on what is it that we need to do in order to preserve our national security and the national security of our allies and our friends.
So the Ayatollah qualifies as a hardliner. And, of course, he's the supreme leader in Iran. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. I mean, he's the tyrant. He's the dictator. He's the one that's not voted in or not voted out. He's the one that decides who's going to be president. He's the one who decides who's in parliament and who isn't. He's the one who makes the deal, or he's the one who kills the deal. if the hardliners in Iran were against this deal, like the Republicans, and if Ayatollah is a hardliner, well, you see how convoluted the reasoning is. To try to defend this deal that so many people now are rising up and speaking out against. Of course the Ayatollah is a hardliner. He's the one, though, that made the deal with the United States. Had he been against it, he never would have made it in the first place. He never would have had his negotiators at the negotiating table. Now, as to the Revolutionary Guard and the Quds Force that are mentioned in that previous clip I played a moment ago, I mean, they're ecstatic right now because their budget's about to increase to the tune of billions of dollars. One last clip from this comment. I think this got a little bit of airplay yesterday in the news cycle with respect to what was said about Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Can you recall a time when a foreign head of government has done that? Is it appropriate for a foreign head of government to inject himself into an American debate?
I'll let you ask Prime Minister Netanyahu that question if he gives you an interview. I don't recall a similar example.
I'll let you ask, but then he goes on and says, I don't recall a similar example. In other words, this is unprecedented, what Mr. Netanyahu is doing, the interference that he's causing. Nothing like this has happened before. That's essentially what the interviewer is saying there, the CNN interviewer, and that's essentially what the president of the United States is saying. Let me switch now over to a piece by Lee Smith. This was at the Weekly Standard, and it's about the Iran deal. The title of the article is Hastening War. It'll be in the August 17th print edition, I believe, of the Standard. It says, war, President Obama says, is the only alternative to his deal with Iran. But if the president's overriding goal is to avoid bloody conflict, why is he arming the Middle East for a shootout that may lead to Armageddon? Now, he's not just talking about arming them in the sense of clearing the path for Iran to build a bomb. He's talking about all of Iran's enemies there in the Arab world that the United States is arming with these conventional weapons. It says the Iran nuclear deal lifts the UN arms embargo and ensures a huge cash windfall to Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, which will fund its imperial wars across the Middle East. As a result, the other side is girding its loins for combat, too. Saudi Arabia is almost certain to go shopping for a nuclear weapon now that the path is clear for Iran to get a nuke. But of more immediate concern, the White House has been selling conventional weapon systems to the to the Sunni Arab states at record levels, Saudi Arabia and also others. Record levels. Later on in this piece, Obama's view of Persian Gulf security is based on the Twin Pillars policy that Great Britain formulated shortly before it vacated the Middle East. In order to cover its retreat, London wanted, now this is taking us back to the early part of the 20th century, in order to cover its retreat, London wanted to establish a balance of power in the Persian Gulf between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's what Obama wants. A geopolitical equilibrium, as he puts it, that will stabilize the region while the United States retreats. So you have Britain retreating first, then the United States. Decades later, it says the Twin Pillars policy may have been attractive as an academic theory, but there was no balance of power after the Brits left. It didn't work when Britain did this, in other words. There was no balance of power. The United States, he writes, simply filled the vacuum. It was only because of the American presence that there was any stability in the Gulf. In other words, for these past 60, 70 years, it is America that's maintained stability in that region. Now, we've talked about this point in recent weeks, quoting from other articles. But it's interesting here to just show how that we're going down the same path, as Lee Smith brings out, that Britain did before us. The U.S. simply filled the vacuum after Britain left, and it was only because of the American presence that there was any stability in the Gulf. He goes on and gives the example of Saddam Hussein and the first Iraq war back in the early 1990s. And then further down, Lee Smith says, "Not anymore," says Obama. "It's better for America and the Middle East if the U.S. footprint is minimized. The Saudis and others in the Gulf are terrified because they never believed in the Twin Pillars fantasy. Their assessment is that Iran will fill the vacuum left by Obama. Don't be worried," says the president. "The Iranians are far from getting the nuclear bomb, and besides, we're going to sell you tons of weapons to protect yourself." So the deal's going to keep, supposedly, it will keep Iran from getting the nuclear bomb, and then just to make Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states feel secure, they're going to get all of these conventional weapons from the United States. As the U.S. then continues on with its retreat, thinking that this geopolitical equilibrium will hold things steady. Here's how Smith concludes his article. "If it weren't so dangerous, it would be funny. Liberal president arms Middle Eastern regimes dominated by religious obscurantists," it says, "but it's it is dangerous, not just for American allies like Israel and Jordan, likely to get caught in the crossfire, but for global security." It says the conflict Obama thinks he's balancing with the Iran nuclear deal looks more likely to widen throughout the region, spreading from Iraq and Syria to include the Gulf, the Eastern Mediterranean, and North Africa. He says finally it may soon reach capitals in Europe, where Sunni and Shiite fighters will seek to avenge their grievances with the West and with each other. It's not difficult to imagine it touching down on our shores as well. War is not the alternative to Mr. Obama's Iran deal, but its likeliest consequence. It's not the alternative. It's the most likely consequence, the result of this deal. Finally here, I just want to touch on a couple of pieces, one of our own. This is from Robert Morley's piece at thetrumpet.com today, featured there as the top story, why an increasing number of adults are living with their parents. He says more young adults than ever are living at home with their parents. The Census Bureau reports that 20 million adults between 18 and 34 are staying with their parents or their relatives. It says that equates to approximately 1 in 3 who refuse to leave the home nest. And the main point of his article, he goes on and talks about that if we're in the midst of such a great economic recovery, one would think these individuals would be out on their own, you know, buying their own homes or renting apartments at least. It's actually a sign that the economy is getting worse. But I want to key in on what he says later in his article, Mr. Morley. This is Robert Morley's article on today's website, or featured today at thetrumpet.com. He says data from the United Kingdom suggests that some young adults aged 18 to 34 simply prefer an easier life with mom and dad. In a recent survey, a sixth of British adults still at home admitted they liked living the cushy existence provided by their parents. 84% of parents with adult children at home said they still do the laundry for them. So these are basically grown-ups that have never grown up. Social scientists call this failure to launch when young people lack the intrinsic motivation to make the transition from adolescence to adulthood. "We are raising a generation of adult babies," Mr. Morley says there. And he goes on to quote from a Huffington Post piece. But I think that's a good lead-in to this last piece that I want to go through, from Melanie Phillips today at the Times of London. This is her weekly column. And the title of it is "China Can Teach Our Schools a Thing or Two." There's a connection to the economy, as Mr. Morley brings out. Also to the fact that young people today just enjoy the cushy existence of being able to stay at home without having the responsibilities of adulthood. And there's also a tie here to education, the way they're being brought up, the way they're being educated. in schools, in Britain, in the United States. Melanie Phillips says, in China, children are 3 years ahead of their British peers in maths by their mid-teens. The OECD PISA rankings in 2012 placed Shanghai 15-year-olds first in maths, reading, and science. Britain's respective rankings were 26, 23, and 20. She asks, why? Why is it this way? I don't know what the rankings are for Americans, but it surely can't be that far removed from where Britain is on that ranking system. Well, Phillips goes on to describe this BBC-sponsored experiment where a British school here in the UK agreed to have Chinese educators come in and teach them, or teach their students, teach their young people. And further on down in Phillips's column, she says Chinese education, she's just drawing a contrast here between the Western education in Britain and the way it works in China. She says Chinese education is based on discipline, the authority of the teacher, and ruthless competition. All these factors have been significantly undermined or are totally absent in many British schools. The Chinese teach big classes in which pupils are expected to note down what the teachers are saying, learn it, and move on. Imagine that. Large classes where students are there to take note of what the teacher says and then to learn it, to internalize it, and to move forward with it. Philip says this is light years away from the British child-centered approach in which the pupil dictates the pace. Bohun's Chinese class struggled to keep up when their teachers set the pace, but half of them weren't even listening. There was constant low-level disorder with pupils talking, throwing paper planes, and some open insubordination. The head teacher, Neil Stroger, blamed the Chinese teaching style for causing normally well-behaved children to disengage. So here's the British teacher blaming it on the Chinese teaching style. The fact that there was this low-level disorder, insubordination, it's not the children's fault. It's these teachers coming in who expect to have positions of authority, who expect the environment to be disciplined. This, though, prompts the question, this is Melanie Phillips, as to why these British children not only switched off, but reacted to the Chinese teachers with such swaggering rudeness and disrespect. I mean, why would these students switch them off? Why would they respond with such rudeness and disrespect? Phillips goes on and says, for the past half century, the education orthodoxy has held that what is innate in every child is more valuable than anything the teacher can provide. It's quite a statement. It's quite an assessment of education in Britain for over the past half century. What's innate? What's in that little child? Well, that's more valuable than anything the teacher can give. More valuable than anything the teacher can provide. She says, transmitting knowledge, the very essence of teaching, was thus damned as fettering a child's creativity. Out went not just whole class teaching from the front, but any pedagogical rules. Rote learning was considered a form of child abuse. Structured reading schemes based on phonics, the only safe way to teach a child to read, were vilified by numerous educationists as barking at print. Phillips says, with self-esteem now detached from achievement, out went competition so as to avoid hurting children's feelings. 2 decades ago, I derided this as the all-must-have-prizes approach, under which no child was allowed to fail. Everyone gets a prize. And to her credit, I mean, Melanie Phillips has been on this for decades. She certainly has been on the breakdown of the family structure in Britain. She's been riding on that for more than 20 years. And now you have this experiment, and it's put out there on the BBC in a three-part series, so everyone gets to see the stark difference. As she says at the top of her article, this is the title, China can teach our schools a thing or two. That's true. China can teach us a few things about education. Phillips concludes with this. The UK's education revolution, however, was part of a much broader moral shift. All outside authority became viewed as an attack on individual autonomy and freedom. Telling children what to do was seen as a kind of generational colonialism. This is education today, but look, you see the same spirit with a lot of other events in the world today, with a lot of other tragic events in the United States and Britain. I mean, you can have all the freedom to drive through a metal gate and vandalize cars and crash through a showroom window. But then when the authorities show up to put a stop to it, it's the authorities that have to be so careful. It's the authorities that get accused of racism. It's the authorities that get accused of abuse. It's the same spirit. It says this paralyzed parents and teachers, for whom discipline accordingly mutated into a process of negotiation and appeasement of kids who were now calling the shots. And that's what you have happening on the streets of America. You have kids who've never really grown up. They're calling the shots. And unless authorities show up and carry on with some kind of negotiation without relying on any kind of force, well, you're going to have an outcry. You're going to have people saying, we're ready for war. She says the result is the education inhibiting disorderliness that is now a standard feature of so many classrooms. See, it's not just the classrooms. It's now a standard feature all across society. Yang Yung, a science teacher in the Bohun experiment, said, in China, we don't need classroom management skills because everyone is disciplined by nature, by families, by society. Whereas here, that is the most challenging part of teaching. That's what this Chinese educator says. You know, we don't go into a classroom and start from square one with management skills. They come there. Those children come there disciplined by nature because of their families, because of what's expected in society. And for that reason, they can sit down and actually learn from the teacher. And because of that, their marks, their scores, their test scores are so much higher. How come it is that Western educators cannot connect these dots? It's unbelievable, the ignorance. You throw discipline out the window, and it really is a form of child abuse. Because children suffer. They suffer in an environment without discipline. They suffer when others around them who are being disorderly, disobedient, rebellious, are given space to destroy. Everyone suffers when that's allowed, when that's tolerated. What a difference. What happens when you bring a Chinese educator into a British schoolroom, well, you get to see up close why there's such a disparity between those Chinese test scores and those taking those tests from Britain and the United States. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. Send us your feedback or your request to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back. As I said at the top of the show, I'd like to just run through a few of the statistics from this past weekend and really through the year. Over the weekend, we replayed Is There a Real Spirit World here in the UK on our TV stations. We've got one big station that plays the program Saturday morning and then another one on Sunday morning. The Saturday morning station we only added in early July, so it's been going now for 5 or 6 weeks. But with this repeat over the weekend, we brought in 174 total requests. This was a program that was advertising Mystery of the Ages, as I think you know. And before the weekend, as I said to you last week, we had, I think it was 603 total requests over the past year with the other five programs in which we've offered Mystery of the Ages. So this repeat represented the sixth time that we've offered the book, and it wasn't quite the highest. A World Held Captive on July 4th weekend brought in 203 requests. In any event, all totaled now, we have 777 requests that have come in as a result of these programs. So this past weekend, as I say, very encouraging for a number of reasons. For one, it was the fourth highest response we've had so far for this entire year. And it'll probably end up being the second best ever after we get a few more requests that trickle in throughout this week. So that was very encouraging. And then also, it was encouraging, too, just because it was a repeat, but also a repeat that ran 2 weeks after a program in which we offered Mystery of the Ages. So what we're seeing is that Mystery of the Ages really does have staying power. And we've been advertising it more than any other piece of literature. And we're seeing some pretty amazing increases each time around. 777 now total. So we're 39% of the way to our goal of distributing 2,000 of those books by the end of the year as a result of the television program here in the UK. So it is something we'll keep you posted on. Hopefully we can put together a number of other programs that also draw quite a lot of attention to this particular book. I can tell you one thing for sure. Over this last year, I've really enjoyed finding different ways to try to promote this book. Already we've had programs on Who and What is God, which is primarily from the first chapter of Mystery of the Ages. The Spirit World one, of course, comes out of that second chapter in the book. We also had a program on the mystery of God and that it should be finished. We advertised Mystery of the Ages with that and also Malachi's message. And then A World Held Captive from a couple of weeks ago is really the sort of the context in which Mystery of the Ages was written. Together with that, we put a program together on Why Israel, which was derived from Chapter 5 of Mystery of the Ages. So we still have really a lot more that we can cover on the mystery of man, the mystery of civilization. There's also quite a lot of material from chapters 6 and 7 that we could get into, the mystery of the church or the mystery of the kingdom of God. I think there would be room for a program, too, that just kind of stepped back and looked at the entirety of the book and all of the big questions that book asks. Why we're here? Who are we? What is our purpose? The really big questions in life. There's also a story to be told about just the fight for Mystery of the Ages and how that went on for 6 years from 1997 to 2003. a 6-year battle in court to obtain the rights to be able to distribute this book freely. Herbert Armstrong's successors, as you know, if you've followed us for any time, his successors tried to destroy that book, and they tried to prevent us from distributing it. They wanted to bury this truth contained in this wonderful book. And so we've set it as a goal, since the work has expanded over here. The footprint has definitely expanded in the UK with the purchase of the Edstone property in November of last year, and with quite a few of us moving over here in January of this year. There's a few more coming over, by the way. We've had a few students going back and forth. But here in the next 4, 5, 6 weeks, we're going to be having 5 more students from our Edmond campus coming over to the Edstone campus to pitch in, to help with this work, to answer phone calls, to take your requests over the phone, to beautify the grounds, to help stuff mail, to help with distributing this message, with getting this message out to the largest audience possible. I receive my weekly report on the listening audience for this program on KPCG, the Trumpet Daily radio show, and then just looking at the spreadsheet for all of the programs that we produced, 5 of them last week, it looks like that on average, from what we can gain on the TuneIn application, the downloads of the podcast, whether it's from iTunes or kpcg.fm or at the trumpet.com website or the SoundCloud replays, it looks like on average there's about 1,000 listeners for each of these programs, so I guess that would amount to about 1,000 listeners per day. Last week, the most popular one was the one that aired on Tuesday, August the 4th, Baltimore Under Siege. That's the title. Of course, all these titles kind of focus in on one theme that was addressed in that particular program. Each program, of course, has quite a bit more material that was covered. In any event, that one on Tuesday from last week, Baltimore Under Siege, on SoundCloud, it had 625 plays this morning. And you add to that all of the people listening in over the air in Edmond or to the live stream. We have a growing number of people that are doing that, even listening in at this hour. I know this is replayed on KPCG a number of times through the day, but there's quite a few of you that prefer to hear it first when it goes across live. So we have pretty conservative estimates, I think, but with those conservative estimates, it looks like at least it's in the neighborhood of about 1,000 or maybe 1,200 in the case of that Baltimore Under Siege program, but it could be even more than that. For all we know. Also, I thought I'd just tell you that the TuneIn app now has 400 people following KPCG. So if you haven't heard me discuss this before, if you have a phone or some kind of a device and you just get a simple app called TuneIn, you can listen to KPCG live wherever you happen to be on this earth if you have a smartphone. So that's something to keep in mind. And, of course, SoundCloud is also a really helpful app if you're interested in following the program and getting the downloads of those programs later so that you can listen on demand. A few letters that we've gotten in recent days, one, I think, from a couple weeks back. This one from last week, thank you for a truly heart-wrenching TD. Continued prayers for you and this work. That one was in response to what we talked about last week. On what's going on inside of Planned Parenthood. I think we got into that last Monday on the broadcast, and then again on Wednesday. Just all that's happening, that program you'll recall, being disciplined in an out-of-control world. All of these programs, by the way, they're still available at thetrumpet.com. Any of those programs, if you'd like to go back and listen to that program, Baltimore Under Siege, you can find it somewhere there, probably still on the front page of thetrumpet.com. This next response, this comes to us, I don't know where from, but she writes, warmest greetings to everyone behind, I think this might be from the Philippines, Well, warmest greetings to everyone behind God's radio station. Thank you, thank you, thank you, she says, for walking through this open door. It's mind-blowing to think that God had a same radio station back during Mr. Armstrong's days. Words can't express how happy I am with KPCG.fm. Thank you for making it available online as well. It's wonderful to think of how God really loves the world, making the station available worldwide via technology. That, as I say, I think comes from Philippines. Now, if you'd like to send us your feedback or your comments on any of the programs, we have this one, of course. The Trumpet Hour plays on Wednesdays and Fridays. Music for Life, I believe the original airing of that one comes on Monday evenings, Oklahoma time. And then all these programs typically play quite often through the rest of the week, replay through the rest of the week. One final letter or email that came in as a result of the program. It says, the live stream is a true inspiration during the workday when time permits. The music, the up-to-date current events, and the hearing of multiple voices of the beloved brethren is a joy in these days of hectic and stress-filled business life. The professionalism of the presentations bring to mind the listening of such greatly composed broadcasts as NPR, PBS, and many more. All this with the added flavor of knowing what is heard is truth, without agenda, facts, without political pull, and music, without disgust and slander. It says, you are all doing a fabulous job. I thank and praise the Father and His Son, Jesus Christ, for leading you in this work and blessing it with such variety. Well, we appreciate that feedback, and of course, we're only just getting started. It's hard to believe. I talked about how fast-moving this summer has been, but it's hard to believe that we've only been going since, what, May 5th, I believe it was. So May, June, July, a little over 3 months now, and it's only just begun. We certainly have other ideas and other programs in the works down the road, and it's only been a week even since we have connected the Edstone campus to the Edmond campus to where we can broadcast live from here. So that was a big step for us just last Monday. And already it seems like we've gotten quite a bit done just since that time with those five programs last week and now kicking off yet another week. I mentioned that for the Imperial Academy, my children start with their first day of school today. Next week we'll have our first day of classes for Armstrong College. So we're moving very fast now into the fall semester and very excited about the growth of this work, the growth of KPCG, the people being reached in the UK, the number of people calling in or sending in text messages or going to the UK website to get copies of Mystery of the Ages. Of course, we're praying for these people to dig into the books, to really study this free material that they're receiving in their mailbox so that they can come along like you and really be dedicated and devoted supporters of this work. We need them. You need them. This radio station needs them, their prayers, their support. So we'll certainly, as I say, try to make time in the days, weeks, and months ahead to update you on some of these developments in the work and some of these facts and figures and statistics as well. As I say, if you'd like to send us your feedback, let us know what you think about the Trumpet Daily Radio Show or any of the others on this station. You can send your comment or your suggestion to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, we are back, and it is 5 minutes before the top of the hour. I said at the start of the show that hopefully we get to the material in Matthew 7 to make more progress on our study of the Sermon on the Mount. But rather than get into that for just 2 or 3 minutes, I'll just reserve it for tomorrow or for another time and apologize that we couldn't get through more material today. But I kind of had a feeling as I was assembling the news at the last minute before the show, as I accumulated more stories there right at the last few minutes, that it would be difficult probably to squeeze everything in. We have a couple of minutes. I'll just carry on with some of what we're doing with respect to the videos or the TV programs that we're producing over here. I mentioned all the stats with respect to Mystery of the Ages, how that we're up to 777 requests here in the UK over the first 7.5 months or so of being on television. I'll let you know when we have our next program going out that advertises Mystery of the Ages. Last week, we put together a program on the subject of self-discipline, on ruling your spirit well, in which we advertised the book that my father wrote, How to Be an Overcomer. That booklet was put together earlier this year, and it's basically a collection of some of the classic articles that my father's written over the years about sin and our battle against sin. And we did advertise that booklet back in, I think it was March or April, when we were just on the one TV station. And it actually did quite well for us. So it's been a few months since we have promoted that, and we're hopeful that this next weekend in which that is advertised, that we'll get some good, strong numbers from the TV program there as well. The program we did last Thursday on Hiroshima, the 70-year anniversary, we also had an article up just yesterday, by the way, by Abraham Blondeau that was on that same subject, the 70-year anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That program, we'd like to work with some of that material and see if we can produce a program, a TV program that could go on the air over here in which we might offer We Have Had Our Last Chance. That's a small booklet that is now several years old and one that we haven't yet offered here before. And then I mentioned some of the Mystery of the Ages ideas that we had. Hopefully later this week, we can also put in some work on the next program over here that will be able to advertise Mystery of the Ages. So along the way, we'll certainly, as I say, try to keep you updated on what is happening on this side of the world. Until then, we certainly do appreciate you joining us today. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show. I'm Stephen Fleury, your host. And as I said earlier, you can reach us by emailing td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening today, and we'll see you tomorrow.